This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to meet the producer and the writer of the film In the Line of Fire. It stars Clint Eastwood as Frank Horrigan, an aging Secret Service agent who's still haunted by the Kennedy assassination. He was on duty then and wonders if he could have prevented the tragedy by stepping into the line of fire and taking the bullet himself. Now he's trying to stop another assassination. John Malkovich plays Mitch Leary, who plans to assassinate the president. As Eastwood tries to track down Malkovich, Malkovich psychologically toys with Eastwood in a series of untraceable phone calls.
Crowley, why not call me Booth?
Why not Oswald?
Because Booth had flair, panache, the leap to the stage after he shot Lincoln.
Where are you?
Closer than you might imagine. It's very exciting to talk to you. I feel like I know you.
Oh, how's that?
I've read about you, seen photos. You were JFK's favorite agent, the best and the brightest. But that was a long time ago. What's kept you in the game all these years?
Why don't we get together and have a drink? We could talk about that.
Oh, I'd love to, but I think the less you know about me, the better.
Oh, why?
Because I'm planning to kill the president.
In the Line of Fire was 9 years in the making, as one deal after another fell through. My guest Jeff Apple was the one constant during that time. He conceived the film and produced it. Early on, Dustin Hoffman was supposed to star, but for typical Hollywood-type reasons, he had to pull out. Sean Connery and Robert Redford were later possibilities before Clint Eastwood signed. Apple told me he could never have made the film without a big star.
Well, when you're developing a movie, particularly one of this scope, knowing the budget would be about where it was, you need a major motion picture star. And I think you have to be very much aware of what the universe of actors, who they are, and most importantly, could they get the movie made? Because, you know, studios don't make big pictures without a major name. And it turned out in this situation, because we had an older agent, the list of talent who could not only play the role, but could be green-lighted by a studio because of their box office potential, was very limited. It probably, you were talking about a universe of maybe five, six, seven actors max.
Why was it so little? I mean, I would think that there's a lot of older, terrific male stars who are looking for a meaty role.
There are, but there are only a handful that are meaningful in terms of box office. And if you're talking about a $40 million film, that is very important to a studio.
Who's on the list of meaningful of that age group?
Well, Robert Redford, for one. Warren Beatty. Sean Connery. There was a consideration of Paul Newman. But, you know, lately, I don't think there was a sense of his bankability of being able to hinge a whole picture on him of this scope. It's pretty amazing, but it's very limited.
Once you started actually shooting In the Line of Fire, what went differently than what you'd planned?
I would say, in general, what went differently was it was bigger in scope and better than I had ever dreamed. For example, after working on this for 9 years, day one, shot one of our movie was a 40-car motorcade down Pennsylvania Avenue with 3,000 extras, five cameras rolling, and Clint Eastwood, you know, running next to the next to our presidential limo. To me, that was just like, you know, a dream come true. And the entire movie, production-wise, went just like that. It went like clockwork.
What do you have to do to get permission to close off the streets of Washington, D.C. To have a staged motorcade?
Washington, D.C., unfortunately, is, from my experience, the most difficult city to film in this country, without a doubt. And the reason is that there are so many different governmental agencies who have jurisdiction on various different pieces of property. Around the White House, within 20 or 30 feet of the White House, you would encounter probably five different agencies who have owned different or have a jurisdiction over various different areas, you know, from the National Park Service to Washington, D.C. City, to the Secret Service, to the White House, to the Treasury Department. And in order to film in certain areas, you have to get approvals from everybody. It did make it easier for us to have the Secret Service there on our side, who could help usher us into certain areas that they obviously had full control over. And to me, that was very important because I always wanted to be showing Washington in a way that it's never been seen before. We filmed in the interior of the Treasury Department, you know, actual scenes, and right in between the White House and the Treasury Department building as well. And there are a lot of areas there that have never been seen on a big screen movie before.
Anything surprise you about Clint Eastwood's approach to acting in the making of the film?
Well, I had never worked with Clint before, and Wolfgang never had either. And he has a very, very, you know, laid back. I mean, obviously, he's been doing it for a number of years. He's done, you know, untold number of movies. He's the ultimate pro. And I was surprised by his just real relaxed nature in any kind of scene that we were to do. I mean, even where he was doing his own stunts, you know, which I had some concerns about doing, but he didn't. In one of the scenes, he's hanging off a 7-story building for real. And as the producer of the film, and we're in our second week of production, I was very nervous, although he wasn't.
Was there a net beneath him?
There was no net beneath him. Actually, what we did is he had a comfort level because we were using his old-time buddy and friend, Buddy Van Horn, who not only directed, I think, one or two of his pictures, but also has done all of his stunt work. And he coordinated the security on that. We actually had a harness, which he was harnessed to the building. I mean, he could literally let his hands go and hang there. But it was hidden because it was in his stomach and you'd never know it. But still, hanging off a 7-story building, to me, is takes a lot of guts. I don't care what's holding you on.
Why did he want to do it himself instead of using a stuntman?
Well, because if we were going to try to do any other kind of blue screen or special effects, he was concerned that it would be much more complicated and you wouldn't get the real effect. I mean, he's a director and a filmmaker and was first to say, you know, it's not worth going to that hassle. We can make up this rig and let's shoot it for real.
Jeff Apple produced the film In the Line of Fire. We'll talk with the screenwriter after this break. This is Fresh Air. Several years into the making of In the Line of Fire, producer Jeff Apple was looking for someone to rewrite the screenplay. The production company he was working with wanted him to hire a name writer. Instead, he contacted Jeff McGuire and asked him to write a new script. They had worked together on another unproduced film. McGuire wrote the new script long before he knew Clint Eastwood was going to be the lead. I asked him how he reacted when he found out Eastwood had agreed to play Agent Frank Horrigan.
I was delighted. I must be honest, though, and say, you know, there's some of those long speeches that are in there, especially when he's talking about Dallas, and he gets so emotional. I really wondered if he was going to be able to do that or if he would want to do that. He's always been sort of nonverbal as an actor, and he conveys so much with his expressions and with his body language, and he's so wonderful at that. I really wondered if he was going to be interested in carrying out some of these monologues, but he was incredible. And that take, the scene where he's talking about Dallas and when he actually gets tears in his eyes and his lip is quivering, that was the second take that day. And we all, when that was over, we were all just had goosebumps and there were tears all around the room and everybody knew that that was the one. That was just perfect. And it was remarkable. So while I had a little bit of trepidation going into it, very early on, I just realized, God, there's nobody else who could have done this nearly as well. He was just remarkable, I thought, and a wonderful guy. And I think that something that is that he is so charming and humorous in person, and that's rarely been captured on film. And I think that this, you know, comes closer to capturing what he's like in reality than any role that I can think of.
You didn't know that the role would be played by Clint Eastwood when you were writing the script. Once
No.
he was cast, did you write any lines just for him?
No. And that's another interesting thing. I hadn't realized that he played the piano. I hadn't realized a lot of things about him that now seem tailor-made for him.
Mm-hmm.
While I was writing it, I really, when I'm working on something, I try not to envision any particular actor, because you'll inevitably, A, be disappointed if they don't do it, and B, you tend, like, if I knew I was writing it for Clint Eastwood, I probably wouldn't have put in that monologue about Dallas, because I wouldn't have thought of him doing that.
This is the second movie in a row where Clint Eastwood has had the flu, because, you know, he gets sick in Unforgiven also.
Oh, I hadn't realized that.
Yeah. When you worry about getting a fever, you notice these things. But, you know, usually a flu or a cold is played for laughs, you know. Sneezes are always played for laughs, and it's actually pretty frightening when he's sick and in such a position of responsibility.
Right. I just mainly wanted to show that the Secret Service agents, they're on their feet 8 hours at a time often. They kind of scarf down fast food when they're on the road. They're constantly on the move. They are often stuck out in the rain. And if it suddenly starts raining and they don't have a trench coat on or a raincoat or whatever, they can't just say, hey, wait a minute, you know, Mr. President, you know, hold your tongue there for a second while I run and get a coat. You know, they have to just take it and stand in the rain. So they're basically susceptible to all kinds of illnesses on the road, and I just wanted to kind of show that and how an older man would be so vulnerable to that. And then after, you know, while you're sick, you might not necessarily be able to get relief, and you're stuck in that situation that he's in a convention center, where every face in the crowd suddenly can take on a nasty look, you know, and you can begin to see killers everywhere you look, if you're a little bit paranoid and sick, you know, to begin with.
What was your first impression when you heard that John Malkovich would be cast as the would-be assassin?
I was delighted. We had actually talked about some older actors. There was some discussion. At one point, there was even discussion about Jack Nicholson playing him, and Clint actually scheduled a golf game with Jack to talk about it. And I think Jack, though, was busy with something else. And I was always trying to get it. I wrote it to be a younger man. And I always liked the idea that Clint was kind of the Kennedy generation, and that the killer was of the Vietnam generation. And there was something about that dynamic that I thought was interesting. And so when John Malkovich was cast, I hadn't thought of him at first, but immediately I said, oh, yeah, he's such a great chameleon and can just inhabit those different personalities that he plays. And so it was great because, you know, the various disguises and the various personas that he adopts in the film, he just does so convincingly.
So Clint Eastwood doesn't like to rehearse. What about John Malkovich? I bet he likes to rehearse.
No, you know something? He was incredible because he would just show up and, you know, he knew his lines. He always knew the lines, and he would just do them. And if we came and said, John, let's... And sometimes he would show up and we would have, you know, Wolfgang and I would have played with it the night before, and we would give him, you know, new lines, or we would have cut some lines, and he would always just go, okay. And he never complained. He never... I kind of figured, being such an intense actor, I really expected that he would want to talk about his character and that we would go into, you know, all sorts of, back and forth wordplay over, you know, his motivation or something like that. He never got into that at all. He was just very, very much of just took a workmanlike stance and just did the job. Some of the other actors, none of the principals, but some of the people who just came in and worked for 1 or 2 days would take me aside and talk to me for 2 hours about their characters and want to know about the motivation and want to know about each line and all, which was kind of amusing. And yet, you know, they did a great job, so I don't complain about it. But Clint and John, you know, Dylan, Renee, John Mahoney, they all were just very workmanlike about it and just went about their jobs. And it was a delightful set. Everybody got along so well.
Was in reading about the movie, it sounds like there was one part where you were asked to rewrite the script for Tom Cruise to play the role that Clint Eastwood plays now.
Yeah. When we went to Imagine Entertainment, this was like the week before the bidding war got started, so it hadn't been sold or anything. And they had liked the script very much, but I guess they had a relationship with Tom Cruise, and they were looking for something for him to do. And they said, would you be interested in changing it to a 28-year-old agent? And Jeff Apple and I both kind of blanched at the thought, and I said, well, you'd kind of lose the backstory. And they said, yeah, well, you'd have to come up with a new backstory. And I said, well, I don't want to sound pretentious or anything, but I think that the Kennedy backstory is one of the real things that makes the story what it is, that this in this one Secret Service agent trying to heal the wounds that the Kennedy assassination left, I think that, you know, maybe the whole country needs to heal that wound. And I think that's one of the reasons why people respond to the script. And basically we said, thank you very much, and we left. And at that point, I was getting calls daily from creditors asking where the money was, and I had to go home and tell my wife that I just turned down a major sum of money to, you know, that would involve changing the script. And fortunately, she said she'd rather live in a shack than see me change the script. And then a week later, you know, everything was fine because of the script sold to Castle Rock. So, yeah, that was just one brief incident, and it was kind of amusing. Yeah.
Jeff McGuire wrote the screenplay for the film In the Line of Fire. This is Fresh Air.